Support for this podcast comes from Visa, whose Visa Signature credit card offers access to the movies this summer. Details at fandango.com/Visa Signature.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Imagine an America in which the economy has collapsed and people are divided into two classes, low net worth individuals and high net worth individuals. There's only one political party, but parts of the country are on the verge of civil war or class war. The news media is dominated by the New York Lifestyle Times, Fox Liberty Prime, and Fox Liberty Ultra. Most of the news media content is journalists texting about themselves. That's the America Gary Steingart has created in his novel Super Sad True Love Story, which is set in the very near future. It's now out in paperback. In novelist Jane Smiley's review of the book, she wrote, "It's as amusing and harrowing a reflection upon the world we live in now and the direction we could be heading as you can hope to find." Steingart was one of the writers featured in the New Yorker edition, showcasing the 20 best writers under 40. He was born in Leningrad in 1972 and moved to the U.S. with his parents when he was 7. He's written two other satirical novels, The Russian Debutante's Handbook and Absurdistan. Terry spoke to Gary Steingart last August.
Gary Steingart, welcome back to Fresh Air.
So, thank you. It's so great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I'd like you to start with a reading that will give us a sense of the satirical notes that you that you strike in the book. So we've agreed on what the reading will be, so I'll ask you to just set it up briefly for us.
Sure. Well, Terry, what's happening here is Lenny Abramov, who is the hero of my book, is about to return from a year in Rome. He's about to return to America. But you can't just return to America anymore. You have to actually go through this process of reentry. And the program is called Welcome Back, Partner. And it takes place at embassies across the world. So this is at the U.S. Embassy in Rome, or the U.S. Consulate, I should say. And one more thing about it, like all citizens and all people in America, he wears a pendant around his neck called an apparat. And what the apparat does is it basically controls everything in your life. It also ranks you. So when you enter a room, people can say, oh, he's the 18th ugliest man in the room, but he's the 7th richest man in the room. So it also rates your personality. And Lenny's personality is very sparkling, but he's very unattractive. So his apparat is the device that he uses in this scene to communicate with the government. A half dozen of my fellow citizens were seated behind their chewed-up desks, mumbling lowly into their apparati. There was an earplug lying slug dead on an empty chair and a sign reading, "Insert earplug in ear. Place your apparat on desk and disable all security settings." I did as I was told. An electronic version of John Cougar Mellencamp's Pink Houses. "Ain't that America? Something to see, baby," twanged in my ear, and then a pixelated version of the plucky otter shuffled onto my apparat screen, carrying on his back the letters ARA, which dissolved into the shimmering legend, American Restoration Authority. The otter stood up on his hind legs and made a show of dusting himself off. "Hi there, partner," he said, his electronic voice dripping with adorable carnivalesque. "My name is Jeffrey Otter, and I bet we're going to be friends." Feelings of loss and aloneness overwhelmed me. "Hi," I said. "Hi, Jeffrey." "Hi there yourself," the otter said. "Now, I'm going to ask you some friendly questions, for statistical purposes only. If you don't want to answer a question, just say, 'I don't want to answer his question.' Remember, I'm here to help you. Okay, then, let's start simple. What's your name and social security number?" I looked around. People were urgently whispering things to their otters. "Leonard or Lenny Abramov," I muttered, followed by my social security. "Ha, Leonard or Lenny Abramov, 205-328-714. On behalf of the American Restoration Authority, I would love to welcome you back to the new United States of America. Look out, world. There's no stopping us now." A bar from the McFadden and Whitehead disco hit, "Ain't No Stopping Us Now," played loudly in my ear. "Now tell me, Lenny, what made you leave our country? Work or pleasure?" "Work," I said. "And what do you do, Leonard or Lenny Abramov?" "Indefinite life extension?" "You said effeminate life invention, is that right?" "Indefinite life extension," I said. "What's your credit ranking, Leonard or Lenny, out of a total score of 1600? 1520. "That's pretty neat. You must really know how to pinch those pennies. You have money in the bank. You work in effeminate life invention. Now, I just have to ask, are you a member of the bipartisan party? And if so, would you like to receive our new weekly apparat stream, 'Ain't No Stopping Us Now'? It's got all sorts of great tips on readjusting to life in these United States and getting the most bang for your buck. I'm not a bipartisan, I said, but yes, I would like to get your stream. I was trying to be conciliatory. Okie dokie, you're on our list now.
That's Gary Steingart reading from his new novel, Super Sad True Love Story. Gary, so you have some very funny satirical things going on here that are kind of alarmingly close to the present.
So. Yes, alarmingly, I would say. Yeah. You got that right, Terry.
So let's start with what's going on politically here. The reading had a reference to the bipartisan party. What's the bipartisan party?
There's only one party left at this point in America, and it's the bipartisan party. And it's really nice because we don't have to choose between Republicans and Democrats, which were different, but, you know, they had some commonalities. So it's much nicer and more streamlined to have one party, the bipartisan party.
There are great political divisions in the country. There's even an insurrection that happens in the book. What are the divisions about?
Well, the divisions are about whatever happens when a country begins to slowly begin its descent, especially when it's a major country. You know, I grew up in the Soviet Union, and then we came to a Hebrew school in Queens. So I know about dystopia. I know about things that don't work. I know when things begin to fall apart, especially when a country is as big as America or Russia, a country that has a kind of messianic belief in itself, that we are not just important, but we are the most important country in the world. And for countries like that, a decline is never pretty because the landing is never as soft.
Why did you want to write a book set in the future so that you could do something satirical?
There's no present left. This is the problem for a novelist, is the present is gone. We're all living in the future constantly. How I envy...
Wait, what do you mean by that? I'm not sure that means.
Well, look, back in the day, Leo Tolstoy, what a sweetheart of a count and a writer. He wanted, in 1860s, he wanted to write about the Napoleonic campaign about 1812. If you write about 1812, you know, in 1860, a horse is still a horse, and a carriage is still a carriage. Obviously, there have been some technological advancements, etc. But, you know, you don't have to worry about explaining the next killer app or the next, you know, Facebook or whatever, because right now things are happening so quickly. I think that's really at the heart of this novel, because this is the first time I've written a love story. And I actually began to feel something for my characters. I love Lenny and Eunice, and they're from different planets, basically, because even though there's a 15-year difference between them, they're basically standing on opposite cliffs with this huge abyss between them, because Lenny still belongs to the ruminative generation, the generation that reads, that tries to understand its place in the world. And Eunice, who is much younger, now lives, she's a very, very smart young girl, but she lives in a whole different world where the only thing that matter are things that happen instantly. They pop out at you, and then they're forgotten, and we move on to the next thing.
And she doesn't even know how to read books. She knows how to skim texts for information. Do you feel like Lenny, like somebody who is an artifact of the past because you read books and even more artifactful, you write books?
Oh, yeah. No, it's so depressing. I feel like I'm insane to write novels. I'm like one of those, you know, those last Japanese soldiers on one of those islands who's like hiding in a cave and still shooting at the Americans are advancing and he still hasn't heard that the emperor has surrendered. Yeah, that's what I feel like all the time.
So
I'm one of those guys.
What about like your texting life and your smartphone life? Like how distracting has or informative and useful has that been for you? And do you find that your concentration span as a writer or a reader is being changed?
It's over. My concentration, my reading life, it's been shot. I mean, this is one of those cases where I'm not against technology. I love my iPhone passionately. I think it's a beautiful piece of technology. But sometimes technology outpaces sort of the humanity's ability to process it. You know, I think that's where we are right now. I know that's where I am right now because my mind has been sliced and diced in so many ways. There's so many packets of information coming at me, especially in a city like New York, which is so dense with information, no matter where you go. I mean, even our cabs have television screens and info centers built into the back seat. You know, and it's just shocking how is literature supposed to survive when our brain has been pummeled with information, sliced and diced with it all day long at work if we're white-collar workers? We go home. Are we really going to open up a thick text with 350 pages and try to waddle through it? Or are we just going to turn on Mad Men, which is a wonderful show, for example?
It's a great show.
It's a great show, but see, what Mad Men does, which is so wonderful about it, is it takes a lot of the things that make novels great. It takes so much of that novelistic precision, and also it takes time to explain its characters, to develop its characters, and also to try to get into the minds of its characters as far as film will allow. So it satisfies all our narrative impulses. That's what we want, but we don't have to open a book to get it. We just watch it on the screen. The Sopranos, The Wire, Mad Men, all these shows very cleverly are indebted to novels, and all the creators of these shows frequently talk about how they're indebted to novels. I just don't want novels to die, because that's what I do.
Okay, so Lenny, the main character in your book, he's working on a life extension program, and he decides in the very first sentence of the book that he's going to live forever, or as close to forever as he can, through this scientific life extension program. And he says that he believes that any life ending in death is essentially pointless. Is that something that you've dealt with?
Yes. A good friend of mine turned 50 recently. He said, "Oh my God, Gary, I can see that life is not eternal." And I thought, you just figured this out now, you know, because I've been, death has been on my mind since I was a little pup. And I was very, very sick when I was growing up in Russia. The ambulance constantly came to our house. I had a horrible asthma that, you know, is easily treated in America, but they didn't even have inhalers back in Russia. So what I remember the most is just constantly being in that ambulance, trying to breathe, can't breathe. And even as a little child, you're thinking, this means I'm going to die. And what's going to happen after I die? You know, and in Russia, growing up in Soviet Russia, there's not even the consolation of heaven. Maybe you become a great red pioneer in the sky or something, but there's not a consolation of that. So, you know, I always think that a good writer should be growing up on the brink of death. It really sort of lets them see mortality very clearly. All my characters think about death in one way or another.
Did you go through the death of any family or friends while you were writing this book?
Not when I was writing this book, but my grandmother, you know, when we came to America and I was surrounded by completely insane people in all levels of life, this awful Hebrew school, my parents dealing with the horrors of immigration. And there was one woman, my grandmother, who was unbelievable. She whenever the school bus would pull up from Hebrew school, I was already 13 years old, she would run out, and she was so afraid. You know, America's a very dangerous country, Queens especially. She would run up, grab my hand, and just slowly we would walk